Chapter 10. Mitigation. America's prisons have become warehouses for the mentally ill. Mass incarceration has been largely fueled by misguided drug policy and excessive sentencing. But the internment of hundreds of thousands of poor and mentally ill people has been a driving force in achieving our record levels of imprisonment. It's created unprecedented problems. I first met Avery Jenkins over the telephone. He called me, but he was pretty incoherent. He couldn't explain what he had been convicted of or even clearly describe what he wanted me to do. He complained about the conditions of his confinement until a random thought caused him to abruptly switch topics. He sent letters, too, but they were just as hard to follow as his phone calls, so I decided to speak with him in person to see if I could make better sense of how to help. For over a century, institutional care for Americans suffering from serious mental illness shifted between prisons and hospitals set up to manage people with mental illness. In the late 19th century, alarmed by the inhumane treatment of incarcerated people suffering from mental illness, Dorothea Dix and Reverend Lewis Dwight led a successful campaign to get the mentally ill out of prison. The numbers of incarcerated people with serious mental illness declined dramatically, while public and private mental health facilities emerged to provide care to the mentally distressed. State mental hospitals were soon everywhere. By the middle of the 20th century, abuses within mental institutions generated a lot of attention, and involuntary confinement of people became a significant problem. Families, teachers, and courts were sending thousands to institutions for eccentricities that were less attributable to acute mental illness than resistance to social, cultural, or sexual norms. People who were gay, resisted gender norms, or engaged in interracial dating often found themselves involuntarily committed. The introduction of antipsychotic medications like Thorazine held great promise for many people suffering from some severe mental health disorders, but the drug was overused in many mental institutions, resulting in terrible side effects and abuses. Aggressive and violent treatment protocols at some facilities generated horror stories that fueled a new campaign, this time to get people out of institutional mental health settings. In the 1960s and 1970s, laws were enacted to make involuntary commitment much more difficult. Deinstitutionalization became the objective in many states. Mental health advocates and lawyers succeeded in winning a series of Supreme Court cases that forced states to transfer institutional residents to community programs. Legal rulings empowered people with developmental disabilities to refuse treatment and created rights for the mentally disabled that made forced institutionalization much less common. By the 1990s, several states had a deinstitutionalization rate of over 95%, meaning that for every 100 patients who had been residents in state hospitals before deinstitutionalization programs, fewer than 5 were residents when the study was conducted in the 1990s. In 1955, there was one psychiatric bed for every 300 Americans. 50 years later, it was one bed for every 3,000. While these reforms were desperately needed, deinstitutionalization intersected with the spread of mass imprisonment policies, expanding criminal statutes and harsh sentencing to disastrous effect. The free world became perilous for deinstitutionalized poor people suffering from mental disabilities. The inability of many disabled, low-income people to receive treatment or necessary medication dramatically increased their likelihood of a police encounter that would result in jail or prison time. Jail and prison became the state's strategy for dealing with a health crisis created by drug use and dependency. A flood of mentally ill people headed to prison for minor offenses and drug crimes, or simply for behaviors their communities were unwilling to tolerate. Today, over 50% of prison and jail inmates in the United States have a diagnosed mental illness, a rate nearly 5 times greater than that of the general adult population. Nearly 1 in 5 prison and jail inmates has a serious mental illness. In fact, there are more than 3 times the number of seriously mentally ill individuals in jail or prison than in hospitals. In some states, that number is 10 times. And prison is a terrible place for someone with mental illness or a neurological disorder that prison guards are not trained to understand. For instance, when I still worked in Atlanta, our office sued Louisiana's notorious Angola prison for refusing to modify a policy that required prisoners in segregation cells to place their hands through bars for handcuffing before officers entered to move them. Disabled prisoners with epilepsy and seizure disorders would sometimes need assistance while convulsing in their cells, and because they couldn't put their hands through the bars, guards would mace them or use fire extinguishers to subdue them. This intervention aggravated the health problems of the prisoners and sometimes resulted in death. Most overcrowded prisons don't have the capacity to provide care and treatment to the mentally ill. The lack of treatment makes compliance with the myriad rules that define prison life impossible for many disabled people. Other prisoners exploit or react violently to the behavioral symptoms of the mentally ill. Frustrated prison staff frequently subject them to abusive punishment, solitary confinement, or the most extreme forms of available detention. Many judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers do a poor job of recognizing the special needs of the mentally disabled, which leads to wrongful convictions, lengthier prison terms, and high rates of recidivism. I once represented a mentally ill man on Alabama's death row named George Daniel. George had suffered brain damage in a car accident that knocked him unconscious late one night in Houston, Texas. When he woke up, he was in an upside-down car on the side of the road. He went home that night and never sought medical assistance. His girlfriend later told his family that at first he just seemed a little off. Then he started hallucinating and exhibiting increasingly bizarre and erratic behavior. He stopped sleeping regularly, complained about hearing voices, and on two occasions ran out of the house naked because he thought he was being chased by wasps. Within a week of the accident, he had stopped speaking in sentences. Just before his mother, who lived in Montgomery, was summoned to help persuade him to go to a hospital, George boarded a Greyhound bus in the middle of the night. He traveled as far as the money he had in his pocket would take him. Disoriented and uncommunicative, he was forced off the bus in Hertzboro, Alabama, after unnerving some passengers by talking loudly to himself and gesturing wildly at objects he imagined were flying around him. The bus had gone through Montgomery, where he had family, but he stayed on until he was thrown off, with no money, and wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and no shoes in the middle of January. He wandered around Hertzboro and eventually stopped at a house. He knocked on the door, and when the homeowner opened it, George walked inside without being invited, and roamed around until he found the kitchen table, where he sat down. The alarmed homeowner called her son, who came and physically removed George from the house. George went to another home owned by an older woman and did the same thing. She called the police. The officer who responded had a reputation for being aggressive, and he forcefully removed George from the home. George started resisting while being pulled to the police car, and the two men began wrestling and fell to the ground. The officer pulled his weapon and the two were grappling over the gun when it discharged, shooting the officer in the stomach. He died from the gunshot wound. George was arrested and charged with capital murder. While in the Russell County Jail, he became acutely psychotic. Officers reported that he wouldn't leave his cell. He was observed eating his own feces. His mother visited him, but he didn't recognize her. He couldn't speak in complete sentences. The two lawyers who were appointed to represent him at his capital trial were primarily concerned that only one of them would be paid the $1,000 for out-of-court time that Alabama provided lawyers appointed to capital cases. They began squabbling with each other, and one filed a civil suit against the other about who would claim the money. Meanwhile, the judge sent George to Bryce Hospital in Tuscaloosa for a competency examination. Ed Seeger, the doctor who examined George, mysteriously concluded that he was not mentally ill but was malingering or faking symptoms of mental illness. Based on that evaluation, the judge allowed the capital murder trial to proceed. George's lawyers bickered with one another, presented no defense, and called no witnesses. The state called Dr. Seeger, who persuaded the jury that there was nothing mentally wrong with George, even as he continuously spit in a cup and made loud clucking noises throughout the trial. George's family members were distraught. George had been working at a Pier 1 furniture store in Houston before his car accident. He left town without picking up his check, which had been ready for collection for over 2 days before his departure. His mother, a poor woman who knew the value of a dollar to someone like George, found this behavior more demonstrative of mental illness than anything else she could point to, and she authorized the lawyers to obtain the unclaimed check in the hope that they could present it at trial to confirm George's confused mental state. The lawyers, who were still bickering over the money, cashed the check to pay themselves instead of using it as evidence. George was convicted and given the death penalty. By the time we at EJI got involved, he had been on death row for several years, moving inexorably toward execution. When I met him, prison doctors were heavily medicating him with psychotropic drugs, which at least stabilized his behavior. It was so abundantly clear that George was mentally ill that it came as no shock when we discovered that the doctor who had examined him at Bryce Hospital was a fraud with no medical training. Dr. Ed Seeger had made up his credentials. He had never graduated from college, but had fooled hospital officials into believing he was a trained physician with expertise in psychiatry. He had masqueraded at the hospital for 8 years, conducting competency evaluations on people accused of crimes before his fraud was uncovered. I represented George in his federal court proceedings. There, the state acknowledged that Seeger was an imposter, but wouldn't agree that George was entitled to a new trial. We eventually won a favorable ruling from a federal judge who overturned his conviction and sentence. Because of his mental illness and incompetency, George was never retried or prosecuted. He has been at a mental institution ever since. But there are likely hundreds of other people imprisoned after an evaluation by Dr. Seeger whose convictions have never been reviewed. A lot of my clients on death row have had serious mental illnesses, but it wasn't always obvious that their history of mental illness predated their time in prison, since symptoms of their disabilities could be episodic and were frequently stress-induced. But Avery Jenkins' letters, handwritten in print so small I needed a magnifying glass to read them, convinced me that he had been very ill for a long time. I looked up his case and began to piece together his story. It turned out he'd been convicted of the very disturbing and brutal murder of an older man. The multiple stab wounds inflicted on the victim strongly suggested mental illness, but the court records and files never referenced anything about Jenkins suffering from a disability. I thought I'd find out more by meeting him in person. When I pulled into the prison parking lot, I noticed a pickup truck there that looked like a shrine to the Old South. It was completely covered with disturbing bumper stickers, Confederate flag decals, and other troubling images. Confederate flag license plates are everywhere in the South, but some of the bumper stickers were new to me. A lot were about guns and Southern identity. One read, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own damn cotton." Despite growing up around images of the Confederate South and working in the Deep South for many years, I was pretty shaken by the symbols. I'd always been especially interested in the post-Reconstruction era of American history. My grandmother was the daughter of people who were enslaved. She was born in Virginia in the 1880s, after federal troops had been withdrawn and a reign of violence and terror had begun, designed to deny any political or social rights for African Americans. Her father told her stories of how the recently emancipated black people were essentially re-enslaved by former Confederate officers and soldiers, who used violence, intimidation, lynching, and peonage to keep African Americans subordinate and marginalized. My grandmother's parents were deeply embittered by how the promise of freedom and equality following slavery ended when white Southern Democrats reclaimed political power through violence. Terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan cloaked themselves in the symbols of the Confederate South to intimidate and victimize thousands of black people. Nothing unnerved rural black settlements more than rumors about nearby Klan activity. For 100 years, any sign of black progress in the South could trigger a white reaction that would invariably invoke Confederate symbols, and talk of resistance. Confederate Memorial Day was declared a state holiday in Alabama at the turn of the century soon after whites rewrote the state constitution to ensure white supremacy. The holiday is still celebrated today. When black veterans returned to the South after World War II, Southern politicians formed a Dixiecrat bloc to preserve racial segregation and white domination out of fear that military service might encourage black veterans to question racial segregation. In the 1950s and 1960s, civil rights activism and new federal laws inspired the same resistance to racial progress, and once again led to a spike in the use of Confederate imagery. In fact, it was in the 1950s, after racial segregation in public schools was declared unconstitutional in Brown v. Board of Education, that many Southern states erected Confederate flags atop their state government buildings. Confederate monuments, memorials, and imagery proliferated throughout the South during the Civil Rights era. It was during this time that the birthday of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, was added as a holiday in Alabama. Even today, banks, state offices, and state institutions shut down in his honor. At a pretrial hearing, I once argued against the exclusion of African Americans from the jury pool. In this particular rural Southern community, the population was about 27% black, but African Americans made up only 10% of the jury pool. After presenting the data and making my arguments about the unconstitutional exclusion of African Americans, the judge complained loudly. "I'm going to grant your motion, Mr. Stevenson, but I'll be honest. I'm pretty fed up with people always talking about minority rights. African Americans, Mexican Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans. When is someone going to come into my courtroom and protect the rights of Confederate Americans?" The judge had definitely caught me off guard. I wanted to ask if being born in the South or living in Alabama made me a Confederate American, but I thought better of it. I stopped in the prison yard to take a closer look at the truck. I couldn't help walking around it and reading the provocative stickers. I turned back toward the front gate of the prison, trying to regain my focus, but I couldn't make myself indifferent to what I perceived were symbols of racial oppression. I had been to this prison often enough to be familiar to many of the correctional officers, but as I entered, I was met by a correctional officer I'd never seen before. He was a white man of my height, about 6 feet tall, with a muscular build. He looked to be in his early 40s and wore a short military haircut. He was staring coldly at me with steel blue eyes. I walked toward the gate that led to the lobby of the visitation room where I expected a routine pat-down before entering the visitation area. The officer stepped in front of me and blocked me from proceeding. "What are you doing?" he snarled. "I'm here for a legal visit," I replied. "It was scheduled earlier this week. The people in the warden's office have the papers." I smiled and spoke as politely as I could to diffuse the situation. That's fine, but you have to be searched first." It was difficult to ignore his clearly hostile attitude, but I did my best. "Okay, do you need me to take my shoes off?" The hardcore officers would sometimes make me remove my shoes before going inside. "You're going to go into that bathroom and take everything off if you expect to get into my prison." I was shocked, but spoke as nicely as I could. "Oh no, sir, I think you might be confused. I'm an attorney. Lawyers don't have to get strip searched to come in for legal visits." Instead of calming him, this seemed to make him angrier. "Look, I don't know who you think you are, but you're not coming into my prison without complying with our security protocols. Now you can get into that bathroom and strip, or you can go back to wherever you came from." I'd had some difficult encounters with officers getting into prisons from time to time, mostly in small county jails or places where I'd never been before, but this was highly unusual. "I've been to this prison many times, and I've never been required to submit to a strip search. I don't think this is the procedure," I said more firmly. "Well, I don't know and don't care what other people do. This is the protocol I use." I thought about trying to find an assistant warden, but realized that that might be difficult. And anyway, an assistant warden would be unlikely to tell an officer he was wrong in front of me. I had driven 2 hours for this visit and had a very tough schedule over the next 3 weeks. I wouldn't be able to get back to the prison any time soon if I didn't get in now. I went inside the bathroom and removed my clothes. The officer came in and gave me an unnecessarily aggressive search before mumbling that I was clear. I put my suit back on and walked out. "I'd like to get inside the visitation room now," I tried to reclaim some dignity by speaking more forcefully. "Well, you have to go back and sign the book." He said it coolly, but he was clearly trying to provoke me. There was a visitation log that the prison used for family visits, but it was not used for legal visits. I'd already signed the attorney book. It would make no sense to sign a second book. "Lawyers don't have to sign that book. If you want to come into my prison, you'll sign the book." He seemed to be smirking now. I tried hard to keep my composure. I turned around and went over to the book and signed my name. I walked back to the visitation room and waited. There was a padlock on the glass door that had to be unlocked before I could enter the space where I'd meet my client. The officer finally pulled out his keys to unlock the door. I stood silently, hoping to get inside without more drama. When he opened the door, I stepped forward, but he grabbed my arm to stop me. He lowered his voice as he spoke to me. "Hey, man, did you see a truck out in the visitation yard with a lot of bumper stickers, flags, and a gun rack?" I spoke cautiously. "Yes, I saw that truck." His face hardened before he spoke. "I want you to know that's my truck." He released my arm and allowed me to walk inside the prison. I felt angry at the guard, but I was even more irritated by my own powerlessness. I was distracted from my thoughts when the back door of the visitation room opened and Mr. Jenkins was let in by another officer. Jenkins was a short, African-American man with close-cropped hair. He grasped my hand with both of his and smiled broadly as he sat down. He seemed unusually happy to see me. "Mr. Jenkins, my name is Brian Stevenson. I'm the attorney you spoke. Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake?" He spoke quickly. "I'm sorry, what did you say?" He kept grinning. "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake? I want a chocolate milkshake." The trip, the Confederate truck, the harassment from the guard, and now a request for a milkshake. This was becoming a bizarre day, and I didn't hide my impatience. "No, Mr. Jenkins, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm an attorney. I'm here to help you with your case and try to get you a new trial, okay? That's why I'm here. Now I need to ask you some questions and try to understand what's going on." I saw the grin fade quickly from the man's face. I started asking questions and he gave single-word answers, sometimes just grunting out a yes or no. I realized that he was still thinking about his milkshake. My time with the officer had made me forget how impaired this man might be. I stopped the interview and leaned forward. "Mr. Jenkins, I'm really sorry. I didn't realize you wanted me to bring you a chocolate milkshake. If I had known that, I would absolutely have tried. I promise that the next time I come, if they let me bring you in a chocolate milkshake, I'll definitely do it, okay?" With that, his smile returned. His mood brightened. His prison records revealed that he often experienced psychotic episodes in which he would scream for hours. He was generally kind and gentle in our meeting, but he was clearly ill. I couldn't understand why his trial records made no reference to mental illness, but after the George Daniel case, nothing surprised me. When I returned to my office, we began a deeper investigation into Mr. Jenkins' background. What we found was heartbreaking. His father had been murdered before he was born, and his mother had died of a drug overdose when he was a year old. He'd been in foster care since he was 2 years old. His time in foster care had been horrific. He'd been in 19 different foster homes before he turned 8. He began showing signs of intellectual disability at an early age. He had cognitive impairments that suggested some organic brain damage, and behavioral problems that suggested schizophrenia and other serious mental illness. When he was 10, Avery lived with abusive foster parents whose rigid rules kept him in constant turmoil. He couldn't comply with all the requirements imposed on him, so he was frequently locked in a closet, denied food, and subjected to beatings and other physical abuse. When his behavior didn't improve, his foster mother decided to get rid of him. She took him out into the woods, tied him to a tree, and left him there. He was found in very poor health by hunters 3 days later. after recovering from serious medical problems relating to his abandonment, he was turned over to authorities who placed him back into foster care. By the time he was 13, he had started abusing drugs and alcohol. By 15, he was having seizures and experiencing psychotic episodes. At 17, he was deemed incapable of management and was left homeless. Avery was in and out of jail until he turned 20, when in the midst of a psychotic episode, he wandered into a strange house, thinking he was being attacked by demons. In the house, he brutally stabbed to death a man he believed to be a demon. His lawyers did no investigation of Mr. Jenkins' history prior to trial, and he was quickly convicted of murder and sentenced to death. The prison would not let me bring Mr. Jenkins a milkshake. I tried to explain this to him, but at the start of every visit, he'd ask me if I'd brought one. I'd tell him that I would keep trying. I had to, just to get him to focus on anything else. Months later, we were finally scheduled to go to court with the evidence about his profound mental illness, material that should have been presented at trial. We contended that his attorneys had failed to provide effective assistance of counsel at trial when they didn't uncover Avery's history or present his disabilities as relevant to his criminal culpability and sentence. When I got to the court where the hearing would take place, about a 3-hour drive from the prison, I went to see Avery in the court's basement holding cell. After going through my usual protocol about the milkshake, I tried to get him to understand what would happen in court. I was concerned that seeing some of the witnesses, people who had dealt with him when he was in foster care, might upset him. The testimony the experts would provide would also be very direct in characterizing his disabilities and illness. I wanted him to understand why we were doing that. He was pleasant and agreeable, as always. When I went upstairs to the courtroom, I spotted the correctional officer who had given me such a hard time when I had first met Avery. I hadn't seen the officer since that initial ugly encounter. I had asked another client about the guard and was told that he had a bad reputation and usually worked the late shift. Most people tried to steer clear of him. He must have been the officer assigned to transport Avery to the hearing, which made me worried about how Avery might have been treated on the trip, but he seemed his usual self. Over the next 3 days, we presented our evidence about Avery's background. The experts who spoke about Avery's disabilities were terrific. They weren't partial or biased, just very persuasive in detailing how organic brain damage, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder can conspire to create severe mental impairment. They explained that the psychosis and other serious mental health problems that burdened Mr. Jenkins could lead to dangerous behavior, but this behavior was a manifestation of serious illness, not a reflection of his character. We also put forth evidence about the foster care system and how it had failed Avery. Several of the foster parents with whom Avery had been placed were later convicted of sexual abuse and criminal mismanagement of foster children. We discussed how Avery had been passed from one unhappy situation to the next, until he was drug addicted and homeless. Several former foster parents admitted to being very frustrated by Avery because they weren't equipped to deal with his serious mental health problems. I argued to the judge that not taking Avery's mental health issues into consideration at trial was as cruel as saying to someone who has lost his legs, "You must climb these stairs with no assistance, and if you don't, you're just lazy." Or to say to someone who is blind, "You should get across this busy interstate highway unaided, or you're just cowardly." There are hundreds of ways we accommodate physical disabilities, or at least understand them. We get angry when people fail to recognize the need for thoughtful and compassionate assistance when it comes to the physically disabled. But because mental disabilities aren't visible in the same way, we tend to be dismissive of the needs of the disabled and quick to judge their deficits and failures. Brutally murdering someone would, of course, require the state to hold that person accountable and to protect the public. But to completely disregard a person's disability would be unfair in evaluating what degree of culpability to assign and what sentence to impose. I went back home feeling very good about the hearing, but the truth was that a state post-conviction hearing rarely resulted in a favorable ruling. If relief was to come, it would most likely be on appeal. I wasn't expecting any miracle rulings. About a month after the hearing, before judgment was rendered, I decided to go to the prison and see Avery. We hadn't had much time to talk after the hearing, and I wanted to make sure he was okay. Throughout most of the hearing, he had sat pleasantly, but when some of his former foster parents had come into court, I could see him become upset. I thought a post-hearing visit would be helpful. When I pulled into the parking lot, I once again saw that loathsome truck, with its flags, stickers, and menacing gun rack. I feared another encounter with the guard. Sure enough, after checking in with the warden's secretary and heading toward the visitation room, I saw him approaching me. I braced myself, preparing for the encounter. And then something surprising happened. "Hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you?" the guard asked. He sounded earnest and sincere. I was skeptical. "Well, I'm fine. How are you?" He was looking at me differently from how he had before. He wasn't glaring and seemed genuinely to want to interact. I decided to play along. "Look, I'll step into the bathroom and get ready for your search." "Oh, Mr. Stevenson, you don't have to worry about that," he quickly replied. "I know you're okay." Everything about his tone and demeanor was different. "Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'll go back and sign the book then." "Mr. Stevenson, you don't have to do that. I saw you coming and signed your name in for you. I've taken care of it." I realized that he actually looked nervous. I was confused by the shift in his attitude. I thanked him and walked to the visitation room door with the officer following behind me. He turned to unlock the padlock so I could go inside. As I started to walk past him to enter, he placed his hand on my shoulder. "Hey, I'd like to tell you something." I wasn't sure where he was going with this. "You know, I took old Avery to court for his hearing and was down there with y'all for those 3 days. And, well, I want you to know that I was listening." He removed his hand from my shoulder and looked past me, as if staring at something behind me. "You know, I appreciate what you're doing. I really do. It was kind of difficult for me to be in that courtroom to hear what y'all was talking about. I came up in foster care, you know? I came up in foster care, too." His face softened. "Man, I didn't think anybody had it as bad as me. They moved me around like I wasn't wanted nowhere. I had it pretty rough. But listening to what you was saying about Avery made me realize that there were other people who had it as bad as I did. I guess even worse. I mean, it brought back a lot of memories sitting in that courtroom." He reached into his pocket to pull out a handkerchief to wipe the perspiration that had formed on his brow. I noticed for the first time that he had a Confederate flag tattooed on his arm. "You know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think it's good what you're doing. I got so angry coming up that there were plenty of times when I really wanted to hurt somebody, just because I was angry. I made it to 18, joined the military, and you know, I've been okay, but sitting in that courtroom brought back memories, and I think I realized how I'm still kind of angry." I smiled. He continued. "That expert doctor you put up said that some of the damage that's done to kids in these abusive homes is permanent. That kind of made me worry. You think that's true?" "Oh, I think we can always do better," I told him. "The bad things that happen to us don't define us. It's just important sometimes that people understand where we're coming from." We were both speaking softly to one another. Another officer walked by and stared at us as I went on. "You know, I really appreciate you saying to me what you just said. It means a lot. I really mean that. Sometimes I forget how we all need mitigation at some point." He looked at me and smiled. "You kept talking about mitigation in that court." I said to myself, "What the hell is wrong with him? Why does he keep talking about mitigation like that?" When I got home, I looked it up. I wasn't sure what you meant at first, but now I do. I laughed. "Sometimes I get going in court and I'm not sure I know what I'm saying either." "Well, I think you've done good, real good." He looked me in the eye before he extended his hand. We shook hands and I started toward the door again. I was just about inside when he grabbed my arm again. "Oh, wait, I've got to tell you something else. Listen, I did something I probably wasn't supposed to do, but I want you to know about it. On the trip back down here after court on that last day? Well, I know how Avery is, you know. Well, anyway, I just want you to know that I took an exit off the interstate on the way back. And, well, I took him to a Wendy's, and I bought him a chocolate milkshake. I stared at him incredulously, and he broke into a chuckle. Then he locked me inside the room. I was so stunned by what the officer said, I didn't hear the other officer bring Avery into the room. When I realized Avery was already in the room, I turned and greeted him. When he didn't say anything, I was a little alarmed. "Are you okay?" "Yes, sir, I'm fine. Are you okay?" he asked. "Yes, Avery, I'm really doing well." I waited for our ritual to begin. When he didn't say anything, I figured I'd just play my part. "Look, I tried to bring you a chocolate milkshake, but they wouldn't." Avery cut me off. "Oh, I got a milkshake. I'm okay now." As I began discussing the hearing, he grinned. We talked for an hour before I had to see another client. Avery never again asked me for a chocolate milkshake. We won a new trial for him and ultimately got him off death row and into a facility where he could receive mental health treatment. I never saw the officer again. Someone told me he quit not long after that last time I saw him. Chapter 11. I'll Fly Away. It was the third bomb threat in 2 months. As we quickly cleared the office and waited for the police to arrive, the entire staff was nervous. We now had 5 attorneys, an investigator, and 3 administrative staff members. Law students had started arriving for short-term internships, which provided us with additional legal assistance and critically needed investigative help. But none of them had signed on for bomb threats. It was tempting to ignore them, but 2 years earlier, an African-American civil rights lawyer in Savannah, Georgia, named Robert Robbie Robinson, was murdered when a bomb sent to his law office exploded. Around the same time, a federal appeals court judge, Robert Vance, was killed in Birmingham by a mail bomb. Days later, a third bomb was sent to a civil rights office in Florida, and a fourth to a courthouse in Atlanta. The bomber seemed to be attacking legal professionals connected to civil rights. We were warned that we could be targets, and for weeks we carefully hauled our mail packages to the federal courthouse for X-ray screenings before opening them. After that, bomb threats were no joke. Everyone fled the building while we discussed the likelihood of an actual bombing. The caller had described our building precisely when making his threat. Sharon, our receptionist, had scolded the caller. She was a young mother of 2 small children and had grown up in a poor, rural, white family. She spoke to people plainly and directly. "Why are you doing this? You're scaring us." She said the man had sounded middle-aged and southern, but she couldn't give any more of a description. "I'm doing you a favor," he said threateningly. "I want y'all to stop doing what you're doing. My first option is not to kill everybody, so you better get out of there now. Next time there won't be a warning." It had been a month since the McMillan hearing. The first time the office was threatened, the caller had made racist remarks about the need to teach us a lesson. Around the same time, I got threatening calls at home. One typical caller said, quote, "If you think we're going to let you help that nigger get away with killing that girl, you've got another thing coming. You're both going to be dead niggers," end quote. Although I was handling other cases, I was certain the calls were in response to the McMillan case. Leading up to the hearing, Michael and I had been followed several times while doing investigative work in Monroe County. A scary man had called me late one night to tell me that someone had offered him a lot of money to kill me, but he said he wasn't going to do it because he respected what we did. I expressed my appreciation for his support and politely thanked him. It was hard to know how seriously to take any of it, but it was definitely unnerving. After we cleared the building, the police went through the office with dogs. No bomb was found, and when the building didn't blow up after an hour and a half, we all filed back inside. We had work to do. A few days later, I received a different kind of bombshell, this time a call from the clerk's office in Baldwin County. The clerk was calling to let me know that Judge Norton had ruled in the McMillan case. She needed my fax number to send me a copy of the ruling. I gave it to her and sat nervously by the fax machine. When only 3 sheets of paper came through the machine, I was concerned. The pages contained a tersely worded order from Judge Norton denying us relief. I was more disappointed than devastated. I had suspected that this would be Judge Norton's response. For all his interest at the hearing, he had never seemed particularly engaged over the basic question of whether Walter was guilty or innocent. He was locked into a maintenance role. He was a custodian for the system who was unlikely to overturn the previous judgment, even if there was compelling evidence of innocence. What was surprising, however, was how superficial and insubstantial and uninterested the court's 2.5-page order read. The judge addressed only the testimony of Ralph Myers and none of the legal claims we'd presented or any of the testimonies of the other dozen-plus witnesses. In fact, there was no case law cited in the entire order. The order read, "Ralph Myers took the stand before this court, swore to tell the truth, and proceeded to recant most, if not all, of the relevant portions of his testimony at trial. Clearly, Ralph Myers has either perjured himself at trial or perjured himself in front of this court. The following areas of concern were considered in reaching this decision: the demeanor of the witness, the opportunity of the witness to have knowledge of the facts which he testified to at trial, the rationale as stated by the witness for his testimony at the first trial, the rationale as stated by the defendant for his recantation, the evidence of external pressures brought to bear on the witness prior to and after both trial and recantation, the actions of the witness that lend credence to his trial testimony, and the actions of the witness that lend credence to his recantation, evidence adduced at trial in contradiction of the witness testimony on details, and due to the nature of this case, any evidence from any source concerning the inability of the witness to have known the facts to which he testified to at trial. Since the trial of this matter was conducted before the Honorable R.E.L. Key, Circuit Judge, retired, this court did not have the opportunity to compare the demeanor of the witness during trial testimony and his recantation testimony. A review of the other factors set out above does not provide conclusive evidence that the witness, Ralph Myers, perjured himself at the original trial. There is ample evidence that pressure has been brought to bear on Ralph Myers since his trial testimony which could tend to discredit his recantation. There is absolutely no evidence in the trial record or the recantation testimony that places Ralph Myers somewhere other than the scene of the crime at the time it was committed. This cause having been remanded to the court for a determination of whether there is evidence to support the theory that Ralph Myers perjured himself at the original trial, and this court having determined that there is insufficient evidence to support that theory, it is therefore ordered, adjudged, and decreed that the trial testimony of Ralph Myers is not found to have been perjured testimony. Done this 19th day of May, 1992. Thomas B. Norton, Jr., Circuit Judge. While Chapman had suggested that Myers must have been pressured to recant, the district attorney presented no actual evidence to support that claim, which made the judge's ruling hard to understand. I had advised Walter and his family that we would likely need to go to an appellate court for any real chance of relief, despite how positive everyone thought the hearing had been. I was optimistic about what our evidence might accomplish in the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. We were now regularly arguing cases in front of that court. Following my first McMillan argument, we had filed almost 24 death penalty appeals, and the court was starting to respond to our advocacy. We had won 4 reversals in death penalty cases in 1990, 4 more in 1991, and by the end of 1992, we'd won relief for another 8 death row prisoners. The court frequently complained about being forced to order new trials or grant relief, but nonetheless ruled in our favor. In a few years, some of the appellate court judges would be attacked and replaced in partisan judicial elections by candidates who complained about the court's rulings in death penalty cases. But we persisted and continued raising reversible errors in capital cases. We were pushing the court to enforce the law in these cases, and when they refused, we were having success getting the Alabama Supreme Court and federal courts to grant relief. Based on this recent experience, I thought we could win relief for McMillan on appeal. Even if the court was unwilling to rule that Walter was innocent and should be released, the withholding of exculpatory evidence was extreme enough that the court would have a hard time avoiding the case law requiring a new trial. Nothing could be assured, but I explained to Walter that we were only just now getting to a court where our claims would be seriously considered. Michael had stayed long past the 2 years he had committed to us, but he was now scheduled to move to San Diego to start a job as a federal public defender. He agonized about leaving our office, although he was less conflicted about leaving Alabama. I assigned one of our new attorneys, Bernard Harcourt, to replace Michael on Walter's case. Bernard was a lot like Michael in that he was smart, determined, and extremely hardworking. He had first worked with me when he was a law student at Harvard Law School. He became so engaged in the work that he asked the federal judge he was clerking for after law school if he could cut short his 2-year clerkship to join us in Alabama. The judge agreed, and Bernard arrived shortly before Michael left. Raised in New York City by French parents, he had attended the Lycée Français de New York in Manhattan, a high school that was unapologetic about its European perspective on education. After graduating from Princeton, Bernard worked in banking before pursuing his law degree. He had been preparing for a traditional legal career until he came down to work with us one summer and became fascinated by the issues that death penalty cases presented. He and his girlfriend Mia moved to Montgomery and were intrigued by life in Alabama. Bernard's quick immersion in the McMillan case intensified his cultural adventure more than he could have ever imagined. The community's presence at the hearing got people talking about what we had presented in court, and that encouraged more people to come forward with helpful information. All sorts of people were contacting us with wide-ranging claims of corruption and misconduct. Only a few things here and there were useful to us in our efforts to free Walter, but it was all interesting. Bernard and I continued to track leads and interview people who had insights to share about life in Monroe County. The threats we received made me worry about the hostility that Walter would face if he was ever released. I wondered how safely he could live in the community if everyone was persuaded that he was a dangerous murderer. We began discussing the idea of reaching out to a few people who might help us publicly dramatize the injustice of Mr. McMillan's wrongful conviction as a way of setting the stage for his possible release. If the public could only know what we knew, it might ease his reentry into freedom. We wanted people to understand this simple fact: Walter did not commit that murder. His freedom wouldn't be based on some tricky legal loophole or the exploitation of a technicality. It would be based on simple justice. He was an innocent man. On the other hand, I didn't think media attention would help win the case now pending in the Court of Criminal Appeals. In fact, the chief judge on that court, John Patterson, had famously sued the New York Times over their coverage of the civil rights movement when he was Alabama's governor. It was a common tactic used by Southern politicians during civil rights protests. Sue national media outlets for defamation if they provide sympathetic coverage of activists, or if they characterize Southern politicians and law enforcement officers unfavorably. Southern state court judges and all-white juries were all too willing to rule in favor of defamed local officials, and state authorities won millions of dollars in judgments this way. More important, the defamation lawsuits chilled sympathetic coverage of civil rights activism. In 1960, the New York Times printed an advertisement titled, "Heed Their Rising Voices," that attempted to raise money to defend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. against perjury charges in Alabama. Southern officials responded by going on the offensive and suing the newspaper. Public Safety Commissioner L.B. Sullivan and Governor Patterson claimed defamation. A local jury awarded them $500,000, and the case was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. In a landmark ruling, New York Times versus Sullivan changed the standard for defamation and libel by requiring plaintiffs to prove malice, that is, evidence of actual knowledge on the part of the publisher that a statement is false. The ruling marked a significant victory for freedom of the press, and it liberated media outlets and publishers to talk more honestly about civil rights protests and activism. But in the South, it generated even more contempt for the national press, and that animosity has lingered beyond the civil rights era. I had no doubt that national press coverage of Walter's case would not help our cause at the Court of Criminal Appeals. But I did think getting a more informed view of Walter's conviction and the murder would make his life after release less dangerous, assuming we could ever get his conviction overturned. We felt that we had to take our chances and get the story out. I was concerned about the inability of people in the local community to get a fair picture of what was going on. Aside from the hostility we feared he would face if Walter was released, we were worried about what would happen if a new trial was ordered. All of the prejudicial media coverage would make a fair trial nearly impossible. The local press in Monroe County and Mobile had demonized Walter and had defiantly maintained that his conviction was reliable and his execution necessary. Local papers had painted Walter as a dangerous drug dealer who had possibly murdered several innocent teenagers. Monroeville and Mobile newspapers freely printed assertions that Walter was a drug kingpin, a sexual predator, and a gang leader. When he was first arrested, local headlines emphasized the absurd sexual misconduct charges involving Ralph Myers. "McMillan charged with sodomy" was a common headline. In covering the hearings, the Monroe Journal focused on the danger Walter posed. Quote, "Those entering the courtroom had to pass through a metal detector, as has been the case throughout the court proceedings against McMillan, and officers were stationed throughout the courtroom," end quote. Despite all of the evidence presented at our hearing showing that Walter had nothing to do with the Pittman murder, the local press invoked the case to scare up more fear about Walter. "Convicted slayer wanted in East Bruton murder" was an early headline in the Bruton paper. "Rhonda wasn't the only girl killed," was the headline in the Mobile Press Register after our hearing. The Mobile paper reported after the hearing, quote, "Myers and McMillan were part of a burglary, theft, forgery, and drug smuggling ring that operated in several counties in South Alabama, according to law enforcement officers. McMillan was the leader of the operation," end quote. From its focus on his pretrial placement on death row, to the extra security surrounding his court appearances, the narrative in the press was clear. This man was extremely dangerous. At this point, people seemed uninterested in the truth surrounding the crime. During the most recent hearing in Baldwin County, the state's local supporters walked out of the courtroom rather than hear the evidence that supported Walter's innocence. It was risky, but we hoped that national press coverage of our side of the story would change the narrative. A Washington Post journalist, Walt Harrington, had come to Alabama to do a piece on our work a year earlier and had heard me describe the McMillan case. He passed that information to a journalist friend of his, Pete Early, who contacted me and became immediately interested. After reading the transcripts and files we provided him, he jumped into the case, spent time with several of the players, and quickly came to share our astonishment that Walter had been convicted on such unreliable evidence. I'd given a speech at Yale Law School earlier in the year that was attended by a producer from the popular CBS investigative program 60 Minutes, and he also called me. We'd gotten calls from various news magazine programs over the previous few years that expressed interest in covering our work, but I was wary. My general attitude was that press coverage rarely helped our clients. Beyond the general anti-media sentiments in the South, the death penalty was particularly polarizing. It's such a politically charged topic that even sympathetic pieces about people on death row usually triggered a local backlash that created more problems for the client and the case. Even though the client sometimes wanted press attention, I was extremely resistant to media interviews about pending cases. I knew of too many cases where a favorable profile in the media had provoked an expedited execution date or retaliatory mistreatment that made things much worse. We filed our appeal in the Court of Criminal Appeals that summer. With no small amount of lingering uncertainty, I decided to move forward with the 60 Minutes piece. Veteran reporter Ed Bradley and his producer, David Gelber, came down from New York City to Monroeville on a 100-degree day in July and interviewed many of the people whose testimony we'd presented at our hearing. They spoke with Walter, Ralph Myers, Karen Kelly, Darnell Houston, Clay Cast, Jimmy Williams, Walter's family, and Woodrow Eichner. They confronted Bill Hooks at his job and conducted an extensive interview with Tommy Chapman. Word got around quickly that news celebrity Ed Bradley was in town, upsetting local officials. The Monroe Journal wrote, "Too many of these out-of-town riders express open scorn for the people and institutions they encounter here, making no more than a superficial effort to gather facts. Worse, a few have been demonstrably inaccurate. We could do without any more news coverage of the big-time reporter-come-to-Hicktown genre." Even before the piece was broadcast, the local media seemed to be urging the community to distrust anything they heard reported about the case. In CBS Examines Murder Case, a local reporter for the Monroe Journal wrote, "Monroe County District Attorney Tommy Chapman said he believes researchers for the CBS television news magazine program 60 Minutes had their minds made up before ever coming here." Chapman had taken to using a photo of Walter obtained at the time of his arrest that showed him with long, bushy hair and a beard, which Chapman thought made it clear that he was a dangerous criminal. "The person they interviewed at Holman Prison is not the same person arrested by Sheriff Tate for this murder," Chapman explained. The Journal added that Chapman offered CBS the photograph of the real McMillan taken at the time of his arrest, but they were not interested. Prisoners in Alabama are required to remain clean-shaven, so of course Walter looked different when interviewed on camera. When the 60 Minutes piece aired months later, local officials were quick to discredit it. The Mobile Press Register headline was, "DA, TV account of McMillan's conviction, a disgrace." The article quoted Chapman. "For them to hold themselves up as a reputable news show is beyond belief and irresponsible." The publicity was characterized as further injuring Rhonda Morrison's parents. The local writers complained that the Morrisons had to worry and deal with the stress that new publicity could lead many people to think that McMillan is innocent. The local media were eager to join the prosecutors in criticizing the 60 Minutes piece because it implicated their coverage, which had largely presented only the prosecution's theory and characterization of Walter and the crime. But people in the community watched 60 Minutes all the time and generally trusted it. Despite the local media reaction, the CBS coverage gave the community a summary of the evidence we'd presented in court and created questions and doubts about Walter's guilt. Some influential community leaders also thought it made Monroeville look backward and possibly racist in a way that was not good for the community's image or efforts at recruiting business. And business leaders started asking tough questions of Chapman and law enforcement about what was going on in the case. People in the black community were thrilled to see honest coverage of the case. They had been whispering about Walter's wrongful conviction for years. The case had so traumatized the black community that many had become preoccupied with each court development and ruling. We frequently got calls from people simply seeking an update. Some callers sought clarification of a particular point in the case that had been the subject of serious debate in a barbershop or at a social gathering. For many black people in the region, watching the evidence that we had presented in court, now laid out on national television, was therapeutic. In the 60 Minutes interview with Chapman, he dismissed as silly the suggestion of any racial bias in Walter McMillan's prosecution. He calmly professed his complete confidence and certainty that McMillan was guilty and that he should be executed as soon as possible. He expressed contempt for Walter's attorneys and people who tried to second-guess juries. We later found out that privately, despite the confidence expressed in his statements to local media and to 60 Minutes, Chapman had begun to worry about the reliability of the evidence against Walter. He couldn't ignore the problems in the case that had been exposed at the hearing. Given our success in other death penalty cases, he must have feared the very real possibility of the appellate courts overturning Walter's conviction. Chapman had become the public face defending the conviction, and he realized that he'd put his own credibility on the line by relying on the work of local investigators, work that was now revealed as almost farcically flawed. Chapman called Tate, Eichner, and Benson together shortly after the hearing and expressed his concerns. When he asked the local investigators to explain the contradictory evidence we had presented, he wasn't impressed with what he heard. Not long after that, he formally asked ABI officials in Montgomery to conduct another investigation into the murder to confirm Mr. McMillan's guilt. Chapman never informed us directly about the new investigation, even though for over 2 years we'd sought just such a re-examination of the evidence. When the new ABI investigators, Tom Taylor and Greg Cole, called me, I eagerly agreed to share case files and information. After meeting with them, I was even more hopeful about what might come out of the investigation. They both seemed like no-nonsense, experienced investigators who were interested in doing credible and reliable work. Within a few weeks, Taylor and Cole seemed to doubt that McMillan was guilty. They were not connected to any of the players in South Alabama. We gave them files, memoranda, and even some original evidence because we had nothing to hide. I was nervous that if we won a reversal and had to retry the case, we might be disadvantaged by disclosing so much information to state investigators, who would then be better prepared to smear or undermine our evidence. But I was still confident that any reasonable, honest investigation would reveal the absurdity of the charges against Walter. By January, 6 months had passed since we had filed our appeal at the Court of Criminal Appeals, and a ruling was due any week. That's when Tom Taylor called and said that he and Cole wanted to meet with us again. We talked a few times during their investigation, but this time we'd be discussing their findings. When they arrived, Bernard and I sat down with them in my office, and they wasted no time. "There is no way Walter McMillan killed Rhonda Morrison." Tom Taylor spoke plainly and directly. "We're going to report to the Attorney General, the District Attorney, and anyone who asks that McMillan had nothing to do with either of these murders and is completely innocent." I tried not to look as thrilled as I felt. I didn't want to scare away this good news. "That's terrific," I said, trying to sound unsurprised. "I'm pleased to hear that, and I have to say I'm extremely grateful that you've looked at the evidence in this case thoroughly and honestly." "Well, confirming that McMillan had nothing to do with this wasn't that hard," Taylor replied. "Why would a drug kingpin live in the conditions he was living in and work 15 hours a day cutting timber on difficult terrain? What we were told by local law enforcement about McMillan didn't make much sense, and the story Myers told at trial definitely made no sense. I still can't believe a jury ever convicted him." Cole spoke up. "You'll be very interested to know that both Hooks and Hightower have admitted that their trial testimony was false." "Really?" I couldn't hide my surprise at this. "Yes. When we were asked to investigate this case, we were told that you should be investigated because Hooks had said that you had offered him money and a condo in Mexico if he changed his testimony." Taylor was dead serious. "A condo in Mexico?" "On a beach, I think," Cole added nonchalantly. "Wait, me? I was going to give Bill Hooks a beach condo in Mexico if he changed his testimony against Walter?" It was difficult to contain my shock. "Well, I know it must sound crazy to you, but believe me, there were people down there who were raring to get you indicted. But when we talked to Hooks, it didn't take very long before he not only acknowledged that he'd never spoken to you and that you had never bribed him, but he also admitted that his trial testimony against McMillan was completely made up." "Well, we've never had any doubts that Hooks was lying." Cole chuckled. "We started polygraphing people and things fell apart pretty quickly." Bernard asked the obvious question. "Well, what happens now?" Taylor looked over at his partner and then at us. "Well, we're not completely done. We'd like to solve this crime and we have a suspect. I'm wondering if you might be willing to help us. I know you're not trying to get anybody on death row, but we thought you might at least consider providing some help to identify the real killer. People will be a lot more accepting of Mr. McMillan's innocence if they know who really committed this crime." While it was ridiculous to think that Walter's freedom depended on the arrest of someone else, I had imagined that a successful investigation might get to this, and I couldn't dispute that even if an ABI investigation cleared Walter, people would still think he'd gotten away with murder until the actual killer was identified. We had long ago concluded that finding the real murderer might be the most effective way to free Walter, but without the power and authority of law enforcement officers, we were limited in what we could discover. We did have a strong theory. Several witnesses had told us that around the time of the crime, a white man had been seen leaving the cleaners. We had learned that before her death, Rhonda Morrison had been receiving menacing calls, and that there was a man who had been avidly and inappropriately pursuing her, stopping by unannounced at the cleaners, maybe even stalking her. We had not initially been able to identify this strange man. But we did have our suspicions. We had been contacted by a white man who seemed intensely interested in the case. He would call wanting to talk at length about what we were investigating. He would hint at having information that could help us, but he was coy and slow to share anything concrete. He repeatedly told us that he knew that McMillan was innocent, and he would help us prove it. Eventually, after several calls and hours of conversation, he claimed to know where the murder weapon, which had never been recovered, might be located. We tried to get as much information out of him as we could. We also checked his background. He told us that he'd had some conflicts with another man in town, and that the more he talked, the more he blamed this other man for the shooting death of Morrison. When we investigated this theory, we weren't impressed. The other man didn't match the eyewitness descriptions of the person seen leaving the cleaners, and he didn't have our caller's history of stalking, violence against women, and preoccupation with the Morrison murder. We began to think that our caller could be the person who had murdered Rhonda Morrison. We had dozens of phone conversations with him and even met him a couple of times. We were less and less convinced that the man he was accusing of committing the crime was involved. At some point, we asked him some direct questions about where he was on the day of the murder, which must have alarmed him because we heard from him less often after that. Before I could tell any of this to the ABI investigators, Taylor said, "We think you may have interviewed our suspect and may have collected a good bit of information from this guy. We were hoping you might allow us to have access to that information and those interviews." He named our suspect. I told them we would give them access to the information we had collected. None of it was protected by attorney-client privilege. We had never represented this man or obtained anything confidentially. I told Taylor and Cole to give us a few days to organize the information, and then we would turn it over. "We want to get Walter out of prison as soon as possible," I insisted. "Well, I think the Attorney General and the lawyers would like to maintain the status quo for a few more months, until we can make an arrest of the actual killer." "Right, but you do understand that the status quo is a problem for us. Walter has been on death row for nearly 6 years for a crime he didn't commit." Taylor and Cole looked at each other uncomfortably. Taylor responded, "We're not lawyers, so I can't really understand where they're coming from. If I was in prison for something I didn't do and you were my lawyer, I hope to hell you'd get me out as soon as you could." When they left, Bernard and I were very excited, but we remained troubled by this plan to maintain the status quo. I decided I would call the Attorney General's office and see if they would concede legal error in the pending appeal, which would ensure relief at the appellate court and perhaps expedite Walter's release. Another lawyer from the Attorney General's office named Ken Nunnally had taken over the appeal. I had dealt with Nunnally in several other death penalty cases. I told him that I'd met with the ABI investigators and that I understood that there were some case developments that favored Mr. McMillan. It became clear that the state lawyers had been discussing this case quite a bit. "Brian, it's all going to work out, but you'll need to wait a few more months. He's been on the road for years, so a few more months are not going to make that much of a difference." "Ken, every day makes a difference when you're locked down on death row and you've been wrongly convicted." I tried to get a commitment, but he offered nothing. I asked to meet with the Attorney General, or whatever official had final decision-making authority, and he said that he would see what he could do. Within a few days, the state submitted a peculiar pleading to the Court of Criminal Appeals. The Attorney General's motion asked the court to stay the litigation and not issue a ruling because they, quote, "may have uncovered exculpatory evidence favorable to Mr. McMillan that could entitle him to a new trial," end quote. But they needed more time to complete their investigation. I was furious that the state would try to prolong any order granting relief to Walter. It was consistent with everything that had happened over the last 6 years, but it was still maddening. We quickly filed a response opposing the state's motion. We told the court that there was overwhelming evidence that Mr. McMillan's rights had been violated and that he was entitled to immediate relief. Delaying relief would add further injury to a man who had been wrongfully convicted and condemned to death row for a crime he did not commit. We urged the court to deny the state's request and rule quickly. I was talking to Minnie and the family every week now, keeping everyone updated about the new state investigation. "I feel like something good is about to happen, Brian," Minnie said to me. "They've kept him for years. Now it's time they let him go. They have to let him go." I appreciated her optimism, but I worried, too. We'd been disappointed so often before. "We have to remain hopeful, Minnie. I've always told people no lie can live forever, and this has always been one big lie." I wasn't exactly sure how to manage the family's expectations. I felt I was supposed to be the cautionary voice that prepared family members for the worst, even while I urged them to hope for the best. It was a task that was growing in complexity as I handled more cases and saw the myriad ways that things could go wrong. But I was developing a maturing recognition of the importance of hopefulness in creating justice. I'd started addressing the subject of hopefulness in talks to small groups. I'd grown fond of quoting Vaclav Havel, the great Czech leader who had said that hope was the one thing that people struggling in Eastern Europe needed during the era of Soviet domination. Havel had said that people struggling for independence wanted money and recognition from other countries. They wanted more criticism of the Soviet Empire from the West and more diplomatic pressure. But Havel had said that these were things they wanted. The only thing they needed was hope. Not that pie-in-the-sky stuff, not a preference for optimism over pessimism, but rather an orientation of the spirit. The kind of hope that creates a willingness to position oneself in a hopeless place and be a witness, that allows one to believe in a better future, even in the face of abusive power. That kind of hope makes one strong. Havel prescribed exactly what our work seemed to require. Walter's case had needed it more than most, so I didn't discourage many. Together, we hoped. On February 23, nearly 6 weeks after getting the ABI's report, I received a call from the clerk of the court informing us that the Court of Criminal Appeals had ruled in the McMillan case and that we could pick up the opinion. "You're going to like this," she said cryptically. I ran over to the courthouse and was out of breath by the time I sat down to read the 35-page ruling. The clerk was right. The ruling invalidated Walter's conviction and death sentence. The court didn't conclude that he was innocent and must be released, but it ruled in our favor on every other claim and ordered a new trial. I didn't realize how much I'd feared that we would lose until we finally won. I jumped into the car and raced down to death row to tell Walter in person. I watched him take it all in. He leaned back and gave me a familiar chuckle. "Well," he said slowly, "you know, that's good. That's good." "Good? It's great." "Yeah, it is great." He was grinning now with a freedom I hadn't seen before. "Whew, man, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Whew." His smile started to fade, and he began slowly shaking his head. 6 years. 6 years gone. He looked away with a pained expression. "These 6 years feel like 50. 6 years just gone. I've been so worried they were going to kill me, I haven't even thought about the time I've lost." His troubled look sobered me, too. "I know, Walter, and we're not clear yet," I said. "The ruling only gives you a new trial. Given what the ABI has said, I can't believe that they would try to prosecute you again, but with this crowd, reasonable conduct is never guaranteed. I'm going to try to get you home as soon as humanly possible." With thoughts of home, his mood lightened, and we started talking about things we'd been afraid to discuss since we'd met. He said, "I want to meet everybody who has helped me in Montgomery. I want to go around with you and tell the world what they did to me. There are other people here who are as innocent as I am." He paused and started smiling again. "Man, I want some good food, too." I ain't had no real good food in so long that I can't even remember what it tastes like. Whatever you want, it will be my treat, I said proudly. From what I hear, you might not be able to afford the kind of meal I want, he teased. I want steak, chicken, pork, maybe some good cooked coon. Coon? Oh, don't pretend. You know you like grilled raccoon. Please don't sit there and tell me you ain't never had no good coon when I know you grew up in the country just like I did. There has been many a time when me and my cousin would be driving, and a coon would run across the road, and he'd say, stop the car, stop the car. And I'd stop the car, and he'd jump out and go running into the woods and come back minutes later with a raccoon he'd uncaught. We would take it home, skin it, and fry or barbecue that meat. Man, what you talking about? That's some good eating. You've got to be joking. I grew up in the country, but I have never chased any kind of wild animal into the woods to take home and eat. We relaxed and laughed a lot. We had laughed before today. Walter's sense of humor hadn't failed him despite his 6 years on death row, and this case had given him lots of fodder. We would often talk about situations and people connected to the case that, for all the damage they had caused, had still made us laugh at their absurdity. But the laughter today felt very different. It was the laughter of liberation. I drove back to Montgomery and thought about how to expedite Walter's release. I called Tommy Chapman and told him that I intended to file a motion to dismiss all charges against Walter in light of the appellate court's ruling, and I hoped he would consider joining the motion or at least not oppose it. He sighed. We should talk when this is all over. Once you file your motion, I'll get back to you about whether I'll join it. We certainly won't oppose it.